morning and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Mukbil Yavro, filling in for John Tanza here in Washington. Here are some of the top stories making news across South Sudan, Sudan, and the rest of the region this Wednesday, October 16th, 2024. Bora Bora drivers are concerned after new road restrictions are set in Juba.
The road from Madrid to Gaywan and from Gaywan to the ministry's roads should not be used by rickshaw and motorcycle riders.
And Kenya's deputy president, Rigathi Gachagua, faces a Senate hearing after his court appeal fails.
Deputy Gachagua actually yesterday tried to stop the Senate proceedings by filing a motion at the High Court to see if they can stop the Senate proceedings. He was unsuccessful. He also asked for a three-judge bench.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Some Bora Bora drivers plying the busy Juba Road known as the J1 are concerned after a new police order banned them using the road. Others are less bothered since it's not the first time the government has issued such an order, and they say it's government workers who will suffer when motorcycle taxis can't travel on the road. For VOA News, Dennis Lagoni reports from Juba.
Motorcycle taxi drivers known as Boda Bodas are frustrated with the decision to ban motorcycles from the J1 road in the capital Juba. It's a busy major thoroughfare used by many commuters. A Boda Boda driver who did not want to be named usually drives in the area. He says the ban will affect government workers.
To me, actually, I'm not seeing anything bad, but there are some government officials whom we are normally relying on them for those ones who don't have access to cars. For us, without using this road, sometimes it will affect our businesses. Secondly, this road also not being used by the Boda Boda riders. It is also being used by some other government officials who have motorcycles. So if this order is enforced, how will people who are working in the office of the governor, Central Equatorial State, have access to know so that they reach to their final destination?
Last Friday, the spokesperson for the National Police, Colonel John Kasara Kong, announced the restrictions on the J1 road and other busy roads.
The road from Madrid to J1 and from J1 to the ministry's roads should not be used by rickshaw and motorcycle riders. Number two, the road from Equity Bank up to Madrid roundabout is a one-way traffic. Third, cars, motorcycle and rickshaw should not be parked on the main road, especially Malakia Junction up to Konyokonyo Junction.
Emmanuel Ole, a Boda Boda driver operating along the restricted road, says the government should open some feeder roads to ease traffic and make it easier to travel.
We don't need anything from the government, but what we just wanted is let the government open for us the way, because this is the shortest way where we use this. If they cannot open for us this way, let them give us an alternative. Most of our customers within custom area are working there, so we normally text them there. Some, those ones are going to Juba, those ones going to Ecobank, it becomes very hard for us to take them there unless we use airport roads.
Boda Boda driver Wajaras Ismail says this is not the first time such an order has been issued, but he thinks it is always used as a ploy to extort money from motorists.
First, they will ask, bring driving license, logbook. From there, they will say, you don't know this road is not allowed, so that they can eat. This is a normal thing. You just pray to God so that you don't meet the traffic. If you see them, don't go. Then it's done, because they will say you broke the law.
Traffic in Juba is growing daily, and there have been calls to expand roads. Last year, the government unveiled a plan to fix the worst roads in the suburbs to ease connectivity around the city. However, contractors complained there wasn't enough funding to implement the project. For VOA News, I'm Dennis Logoni reporting from Juba.
Kenya's Senate today launched the impeachment trial of Deputy President Rigathi Gachagua after the embattled politician lost another court bid to stop the process. Gachagua, a businessman from Kenya's biggest ethnic group, the Kikuyu, weathered previous corruption scandals to become President William Ruto's running mate in the 2022 election. But in recent weeks, he has complained of being sidelined by the president and had been accused of supporting youth-led anti-government protests that broke out in June. For more news on today's impeachment proceedings, my colleague Yehias Wahib spoke with our Nairobi bureau chief, Mariama Diallo, who is closely monitoring the situation.
Basically, to go back a little bit, last week, Kenya's National Assembly actually voted to basically impeach the country's deputy president, Rigathi Gachagua, over, 11 counts. And those 11 counts of accusations include corruption, abuse of office, and all kinds of other stuff. So that was last week. So basically, what's happening today is that the motion was moved to the Senate. So they are having the hearing, proceeding hearings today at the Senate. And in fact, as we are speaking, the council, on both sides, meaning the council for the National Assembly, was told that they had 30 minutes to kind of make their opening statement. And they just finished. I think that was led by Honorable Orango, who started by saying literally that impeachment is not new to the Senate, but this is new. This is the first time in the history of Kenya that they are actually trying to remove a DP by impeachment.
And Miriama, does this case highlight the friction between Gachagua and President William Ruto? Gachagua believes the impeachment process has Ruto's blessing.
Well, I think the friction could be starting even back from during the Gen Z's protest. I remember at the time when President Ruto will come out and say something, DP Gachagua will come out on the other side and say something. It's, literally the two of them seemed very disconnected. Yeah, some people who support Gachagua say that this is basically, just trying to get rid of him. It's a political lynching, basically, accusing either the president and his supporters to be trying to get rid of him. At the same time, the Senate and Parliament are saying that, they are making their cases, that there are actually 11 counts, as I said, including undermining the government and insubordination, like gross misconduct. So they have a list of charges that they are accusing him of. I also have to say that DP Gachagua actually yesterday tried to stop the Senate proceedings by filing a motion at the High Court to see if they can stop the Senate proceedings. He was unsuccessful. He also asked for a 3-judge bench to be appointed, and that also fell through today.
And lastly, Mariama, do you think these tensions with the impeachment risk introducing more uncertainty for investors and others in this East Africa's commercial hub?
Well, I guess that's a great question, because some of the arguments that people who are supporting the DP's side are talking about that this is kind of a distraction, that Kenya has gone through a lot of issues recently, the huge protests about the proposed tax increases, the high cost of living, about 50 people who have died during these protests. So people who support DP Gachagua are talking about the fact that this is a distraction, that Kenya really has so many other things to concentrate on instead of, spending a week or 2 weeks doing trials like this, a trial basically against one person. So that's basically the argument that some of the people on Mr. Gachagua's side are saying. But, I mean, I guess the people who also are talking about good governance and who feel that, maybe the institutions are not being respected the way a deputy president should respect those kinds of rules. They're the ones also who are making the arguments and listing their charges, taking it all the way to the Senate and hoping to remove, an official like DP Gachagua.
That was VOA's Nairobi Bureau Chief Mariama Diallo speaking to Africa News Tonight host Yehei Swahib from Nairobi. Chorus International is a non-governmental organization based in Baltimore, Maryland. It addresses humanitarian and developmental challenges in Africa and helps local authorities adopt technology to improve transparency, accountability, and efficiency. Working with local authorities, Chorus International uses tech for development, digital platforms in Sierra Leone and South Sudan to streamline data, eliminate ghost workers, and improve service delivery in education, healthcare, and public services. For details, VOA technology correspondent Paul Ndiho spoke with Hannah Graham, managing director of CGA Technologies, which is part of Chorus International.
We're CGA Technologies, so we're a consultancy. We're part of the Chorus International family. And we're dedicated to using data to improve service delivery. particularly in education and health and social protection. A lot of what we do is we work with governments, national governments, often in sub-Saharan Africa, but beyond. And we support them to to use data to improve the way that service is delivered and to make sure that populations can better access those services.
There are a lot of people who have said that data is the new oil. And to your point, a lot of governments are leveraging that data to improve our services for their people. When it comes to data, Africans are not collecting enough data.
There really is a lack of data, or at least of good quality data, in most of the places that we work. Data is, of course, very valuable, and the data, especially of a lot of the people that we work with, a lot of the people that we support governments to collect data on, often are, you know, the most vulnerable in societies, you know, children, vulnerable people. And so the data of those people is a really precious resource, and there's a much higher responsibility to protect and to use that data responsibly. But certainly the lack of data is a big problem, and it means that governments can't adequately plan for and deliver services as effectively as they need to. You know, we see examples in education, for example, of governments just not really able to plan and deliver education service as well, because they really just actually don't have a clear picture of who the children are, the learners are, that they're trying to reach, how many they are and where they are.
So what type or kind of data are we talking about?
Great question. So for example, in the education sphere, which I just mentioned, we do a lot of work with governments in education in Sierra Leone and in South Sudan. Similarly in the health sector and in the social protection sector, who collect data on schools, on teachers, on learners in the classroom. But often what they're doing is they're collecting data on an annual basis. So maybe once a year, they'll do a survey where they'll visit, they'll have enumerators visit each school, and they'll kind of just take a note of what's happening at that school on a given day, the teachers who were there, the condition of the school on that day, the number of learners who were there. And what it means is the government are using that survey, those survey results, to plan for what they need to budget for, how they need to manage their resources for the rest of the year. But what they're using as a result of that is they might just have aggregate numbers of learners in a classroom. And what that really means when you break it down is that you don't know if you have the same children who start at the beginning of an academic year as finish. What we're saying and what we're doing and how we're supporting governments is by saying you need to have much more data, you need to generate much more data, and then you really need to figure out how you're going to use that in a more effective way to plan and deliver services.
One of the things that I see as a challenge is how they input data. Most people are still writing on a piece of paper and put it in a folder and stack it away. Are we talking about different inputs of data, let's say using technology to do that in some of these places that you operate?
But we're often working, you know, in rural healthcare centers or schools in hard to reach areas, you know, working with, you know, teachers, you know, at the last mile where digital literacy might be quite low, of course, is a challenge. However, you know, the world is increasingly digitalized. And actually, mostly what we find is that people have, you know, a really high degree of interest in wanting to learn these skills. And actually, we really find when people understand the value of data and what it means for them, not just that it's being reported to go somewhere else, but that but they can see the benefits themselves. They can understand their trends. They can understand how their school is performing, or they can, you know, a healthcare center can make sure that its payroll is being regularly updated and they know who is meant to be working at their facility on a day-to-day basis.
Hannah Graham is with CGA Technologies, the tech arm of Chorus International. She was speaking with my colleague, Paul Ndiho. You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. Coming up on South Sudan in Focus, flood victims from Chad seek shelter in nearby Cameroon.
Hello, listener of South Sudan in Focus. We have an exciting new segment dubbed Words of Wisdom. We want to hear your thoughtful proverbs that echo through your community. This is another chance for you to share wisdom from your roots. All you need to do is record a proverb in a language of your choice, tell us its English translation and what it means. Keep it brief, authentic, and represent your community. Your recorded proverb shall be sampled on South Sudan in Focus every Wednesday. Send your recording via our WhatsApp number, +1 202 630 8011. That is +1 202 630 8011.
For today's words of wisdom, we have a submission from Central Equatorial State.
I am Luate Michael from Loka West Salanya County, Central Equatorial State. My proverb goes like this in my local language, Bodilu. Koplet miunda yesu ngai kaet togeleng lepe siki jari ngai kune monge seidin. This is translated as, when a hyena want to feed on its young ones, it first accuses them of smelling like goats. So this means that you cannot trust anybody, even if within your family, because anytime he can turn against you.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Makbil Yabro. Chad is pleading for urgent international assistance for more than 2 million people affected by floods that have claimed at least 600 lives. Moki Edwin Kinzika reports from neighboring Cameroon, where some Chadian civilians are rushing for safety.
Chadian cattle rancher Abdurrahman Abu tells Cameroon officials in Kuseri that he lost all of his livestock in floods that are sweeping through his country. Abdurrahman says floods carried away his house at Digangali village near Chad's capital N'Djamena on Monday, and he doesn't know where his wife and five children are. The town of Kuseri is on Cameroon's northern border with Chad. Cameroon officials say Abdurrahman is one among close to 700 civilians who this week sought refuge in Kuseri and neighboring border villages after weeks of flooding. Farmer Maloni Dziano says he fled from N'Djamena to Kuseri this week. Dziano says his rice plantation is in ruins after heavy rains unleashed flooding that also destroyed buildings and public structures in N'Djamena this week. He says his family of three has had no food to eat since they left N'Djamena on Sunday. Dziano says his family and other flood victims hope the governments of Chad and Cameroon and donors would help them with food, water, and shelter. The Cameroon government says some of the flood victims from Chad are living with relatives in Cameroon, while others are in mosques, schools, and churches. It is not clear how many Chad citizens have crossed into Cameroon. Chad's government says more than 600 civilians have been killed and about 250,000 homes washed away by floods that became severe in August and may continue into November. At least 450,000 hectares of land and several hundred farms and plantations have been flooded, and more than 1 million cattle, goats, and sheep are either dead or missing. Chad's Prime Minister Alamaye Halina visited flood victims in N'Djamena over the past week. He spoke on Chad State TV on Tuesday. He says he wants to assure citizens that Chad's government, under the leadership of President Mohamed Idriss Déby, is very concerned about the floods, which are the most destructive in the country's history. He says Déby has ordered all district councils to provide victims with the necessary health and humanitarian care while waiting for more assistance from the international community. Dans le travail pour aider le comité dans le curage de Canevo. Chadian authorities say many communities face severe hunger and about 2 million people need humanitarian assistance. Many families in Chad are seeking shelter at makeshift sites and schools. The government says hundreds do not have access to hospitals, clean drinking water, sanitation and hygiene. Officials say hospitals are crowded with wounded patients and malnourished children, and diseases such as diarrhea, malaria and skin infections may spike. Last week, Cameroon reported about 70,000 civilians fled into Chad to escape floods along the border. Unusually heavy rains have battered parts of Chad, Cameroon and Nigeria for weeks. The United Nations reports that rainfall this week continues to affect western, central and southern Chad, in particular the provinces of Lac, Mondoul, Moen Chari, Tadjili, Mayokebi East and Bata. For VOA News, I am Moki Edwin Kinzika in Yaoundé, Cameroon.
The United States has sent a letter to Israel demanding it facilitate an immediate surge in humanitarian assistance in Gaza. The letter, which the Pentagon said was intended to remain private, comes as a U.S. Terminal High Altitude Area Defense Battery, or THAAD, has started to arrive in Israel to defend against missile attacks. VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb has more.
With the humanitarian situation in Gaza worsening, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken and Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin sent a letter to their Israeli counterparts calling for concrete commitments to improve the humanitarian situation within 30 days. A failure to do so, they say, could have, quote, implications for U.S. policy. U.S. State Department spokesperson Matthew Miller.
The secretary, along with Secretary Austin, thought it was appropriate to make clear to the government of Israel that there are changes that they need to make again to see that the level of assistance making it into Gaza comes back up from the very, very low levels that it is at today.
According to the U.S., a similar request was sent to Israel in April that led to increased humanitarian assistance into Gaza. But that assistance is now down by more than 50% from what it was at its peak. Deputy Pentagon Press Secretary Sabrina Singh.
The land routes are the most effective way to get aid flowing to the civilians that need it most. So, of course, we want to see those corridors open up. That's something that the secretary continues to emphasize in his calls.
The administration declining this week to discuss what would happen should Israel fail to meet the letter's demands.
Is the U.S. military debating right now whether or not to withhold military support to Israel?
Israel continues to receive support from the United States, whether it be through FMS sales or what you're seeing, you know, that we're doing in Israel self-defense. I just don't have more to provide.
A U.S. THAAD battery, along with dozens of American troops to operate it, began arriving in Israel this week. Deputy Pentagon Press Secretary Sabrina Singh.
You've seen our destroyers engage from the sea. This is now a land-based capability that will be able to help defend against another ballistic missile attack if Iran did choose to respond in that way.
Iran has launched two direct attacks against Israel, with Iran most recently firing about 200 ballistic missiles toward the country. Tel Aviv has not yet responded to the latest attack. Carla Babb, VOA News, The Pentagon.
The U.S. eyes are on the seven so-called battleground states that are expected to determine the outcome of the 2024 presidential election. While some of them have shifted politically over the years, the western swing state of Nevada does not lean strongly toward one major party or the other. VOA's Dora Mekwa reports from Las Vegas.
Nevada, home to 3.1 million people, is probably best known for Las Vegas, its most famous city, also known as Sin City. Tom Riley is a professor and expert on democracy and citizenship at Arizona State University.
But they're a bit of a paradox. I mean, they're seen as perhaps a liberal state in some sense because it was the first state that really pushed no-fault divorce. It has gambling in certain counties. It allows prostitution. But it also has this undercurrent of being very, very conservative in some respects.
Nevada reliably voted Republican from the late 1960s until the early 2000s. Since then, the state regularly swings between the two political parties. Nevada's population has more than tripled since 1980. Many recent newcomers are from predominantly liberal California. Ken Miller is an assistant professor of political science at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas.
What's happened is the Clark County, which is the county where Las Vegas sits, is now 72% of the voting population in this state. So what has happened to Nevada is what was once a rural Mountain West state has become an urban West Coast state.
Nevada college student David Cardenas has noticed the state's political split.
There's Vegas, and then there's the rest of Nevada. And from my knowledge, Vegas tends to be more on the Democrat side, whereas the rest of Nevada is more Republican. But then again, most of the population is in Vegas.
Despite the population explosion, Nevada remains heavily working class, with many residents working manual jobs, says UNLV's Miller.
So things like wages, things like unemployment, things like housing affordability, just inflation in general, so things like fuel prices, all of those things affect people a little bit more here in Nevada than they might some other states.
College students at the University of Nevada at Las Vegas outline their top issues. Some will vote for the first time now that they've reached the voting age of 18.
Definitely abortion, definitely the economy. What else? Education as well.
The state of the economy, probably just the border.
I'm kind of broke college kid. I would just like to be able to better afford food. I would like to be able to have a single job that pays enough to help me with all of my needs.
When they vote in November's general election, Nevadans will also vote on whether to install a right to abortion in the state constitution. Rebecca Gill is director of the Women's Research Institute of Nevada.
The issue overall has already proven to be a big driver, a big motivator of turnout in prior elections, and I think this one will be no different.
Still, Miller says no one should underestimate former President Donald Trump's chances of winning Nevada.
I think that Trump is being perceived as a candidate unlikely to win Nevada simply because he hasn't won the last two times. I wouldn't discount the importance of economic issues as driving the decision for voters in this state.
Nevada's critical role as a battleground state is why both presidential nominees, Trump and Vice President Kamala Harris, are spending time here. Because ultimately, what happens in Vegas could determine who will lead America for the next 4 years. Dora McQuar, VOA News, Las Vegas.
Hey, Franco. And that wraps it up for us this Wednesday. We invite you to check out voaafrica.com for all your favorite programs and news updates. For more news, head on over to www.voaafrica.com/South Sudan. We now leave you with this song, Likikiri by Franco Lokunyumi.
Lopero, Likikira Pure, Likikira Toto, Ubi, Montgomery. In 1800, my grandpa told me that Yemari lo kajun lo putu kane kulo Yemari de. Pero kajuna, kungiro la durunda dema, monyera woto gala dunoka, lepe woti jika sinyiro na vayu boko, kuyase kumonye longiro na. Namedangiro nonona, purangiro nabu. Namedangiro nonona, purakakitani. Namedangiro nonona.
We have been listening to Likikiri by Franco Lokunyumi. I'm your host, Mukbil Yabaro, in Washington. On behalf of our engineer, Audrey Rodriguez, and producer, Kwame Ofori, thanks for tuning in. We'll see you back here tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
Odiru no badana bo, numero da kapitani. Kumote na rugati, no badana bo. Kobololonge, bonga tiki lo tiki denda na beri. Kukinga timure, kukinga
Ati musala, hey, mona yoyota, oh, you never.